I just didn't think it was going to be necessary. After yesterday, I just don't know now.
Following President Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin, Alaska senators weigh possible congressional action. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the journey a salmon takes from the sea to the dinner table.
We call it popcorn. Whenever fishing's good, that's when it's like popcorn popping. It's just hit.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Alaska's U.S. senators are among the Republicans who've criticized President Trump for not standing up to Russian President Vladimir Putin in Finland this week. But beyond strongly worded tweets, is there more Congress should do to show Trump they disapprove of what looked to some critics like capitulation? Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin tracked down the two senators today and found they didn't have definitive answers.
In Helsinki on Monday, it seemed Trump was siding with Putin over American intelligence agencies on their conclusion that Russia interfered with the election that put him in office.
I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
24 hours later, Trump walked it back, in a way. He says he meant to say he didn't see any reason why it wouldn't be Russia.
I accept our intelligence community's conclusion that Russia's meddling in the 2016 election took place. Could be other people also. There's a lot of people out there.
Senator Lisa Murkowski remains critical of the president.
This has been more than unfortunate. It's been a debacle. So the fact that he is kind of retracing his steps is important, but he sure stepped in it yesterday.
Political scientist Molly Reynolds at the Brookings Institution says lawmakers can deploy more than words.
If Congress is serious about trying to send a message to President Trump that they don't approve of what he's been doing, they have a range of options available to them, and it's a question of whether or not they want to use them.
Among other things, Reynolds says they could pass a bill that protects Robert Mueller's investigation into election interference. On Monday, Trump blamed that investigation for driving a wedge between the U.S. and Russia. Another option, Reynolds says, is senators could withhold their votes for the president's priorities, such as his Supreme Court nominee. Murkowski says she's looked at a few legislative options, including a bill to protect the Mueller investigation. When the proposal first surfaced months ago, Murkowski wasn't enthusiastic.
I just didn't think it was going to be necessary. After yesterday, I just don't know now.
Murkowski rejects the idea of sending a message to the president by blocking confirmation of his nominees. She says when Congress refuses to act on nominations or bills, it moves power to the executive branch.
So if anything, I think it calls for greater congressional action and not a complete blockade.
Senator Dan Sullivan says he hasn't heard any concrete proposals for bills to condemn the president for what he said in Helsinki.
You know, there's some discussion on it. I don't know what that would be.
When asked about congressional action to send a message to the president, Sullivan responded with ways to send a message to Putin.
The best way to push back on the Putin regime, the way that Putin understands more than almost any other thing, is to continue what we've been doing, which is building up our military defenses.
The senator says he doesn't see the need to pass a bill to protect the Mueller probe because he doesn't think it's likely Mueller will be fired. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Governor Bill Walker today signed into law a statewide ban on smoking in Alaska workplaces, including restaurants, bars, and offices. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki sponsored SB 63, which aims to eliminate the health effects from secondhand smoke in workplaces. Walker, who signed the bill in Anchorage, says Alaskan workers should not have to sacrifice their health for their livelihood. The ban includes e-cigarettes. It goes into effect on October 1st. Federal authorities are now investigating the apparent disappearance of a cruise ship passenger in Glacier Bay last week. It's the second passenger reported overboard from an Alaska-bound cruise ship this month. The Holland America cruise ship Westerdam reported the 69-year-old male passenger missed a scheduled medical appointment on Friday afternoon and may have gone overboard. Authorities did not identify him any further. The ship's crew conducted a ship-wide search and notified National Park Service officials as the vessel left Glacier Bay National Park. Matthew Cahill of the National Park Service in Bartlett Cove says they started a search Friday evening with 15 people, three vessels, and a fixed-wing aircraft.
The Coast Guard provided us with probability maps based on currents and the tidal motion. And so we searched shorelines and waterways from Beardsley Entrance area, right in upper part of Satakade Narrow inside the mouth of Glacier Bay, out of the bay, including Pleasant Island and Lemmershire Island, the two islands that are right outside to the east and the west of the mouth of Glacier Bay.
The search was suspended about 7 o'clock Saturday evening. Cahill says the cruise line reported closed-circuit television footage had indicated the man went overboard about 6:45 Friday morning. That's about 9 hours before his medical appointment when he was discovered missing. Cahill says the Coast Guard and the FBI started an investigation when they met the ship in Seward on Sunday. FBI spokesperson Stacy Feiger-Plessier says it's standard practice for their agency to investigate such disappearances or deaths in U.S. waters. The Coast Guard and Holland America did not respond to calls for comment today. On July 10th, the body of a 73-year-old man was recovered near the Strait of Juan de Fuca in Washington State. An Alaska state lawmaker says he did not disclose the existence of a confidential ethics complaint to a reporter. Republican Representative David Eastman testified at a formal hearing before a legislative ethics panel today. An ethics subcommittee in January said it had found probable cause that Eastman violated ethics law by disclosing the existence of a complaint that was considered confidential. The subcommittee recommended that Eastman lose his seat on the ethics committee, and the state house removed him, which Eastman says, well, he argued was premature. Eastman says he takes ethics issues seriously. The Alaska Journal of Commerce in January reported Eastman told one of its reporters last year that a complaint had been filed against another legislator and suggested the reporter check with the ethics office. Eastman's attorney disputed that characterization. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Kodiak locals celebrate ancestral artifacts on loan from France.
Just because there's so little that's written about them, and it was an art that was lost on Kodiak for a long time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Independent U.S. House candidate Elise Galvin topped her competitors in fundraising during the last quarter, raising more than $245,000. According to a federal filing, Galvin had more than $265,000 on hand as of June 30th. Galvin is running in the Democratic primary in Alaska on August 21st. Her highest-profile rival is Democrat Dimitri Shane. Shane reported raising nearly $130,000 between April and June. That includes a personal loan of more than $100,000. Shane ended the quarter with nearly $120,000 available. On the Republican side, incumbent Representative Don Young reported raising more than $175,000 during the quarter. He held the edge in cash on hand among all candidates with just under $470,000 available. Young has served in the House since 1973. One of his GOP challengers, Thomas John Nelson, reported raising a nominal amount of money. An Anchorage man has been sentenced to life in prison for shooting two men before leaving them to die on a secluded road outside Palmer in 2016. 36-year-old Matthew James Sharber pleaded guilty in December to kidnapping, carjacking, and using a gun in the furtherance of a violent crime. Federal prosecutors say Sharber and his accomplices attacked the two victims, who are brothers, after they stole Sharber's wallet. Prosecutors also allege Sharber was also dealt methamphetamine, which he's indicted for in a separate case. According to court documents, Sharber wanted to, quote, protect his business and make it known in the neighborhood he would take care of his own problems. Assistant U.S. Attorney Will Taylor argued the case.
Mr. Sharber did everything necessary to complete a homicide.
The court documents say Sharber lured the two men, who are only identified by their initials, to his apartment in October of 2016. Sharber's co-defendants, Corey Silva and Michael Elder, bound the victims with speaker wire and beat them. Prosecutors say they loaded the victims into their own Subaru Legacy and Sharber drove them to Hatcher Pass. Prosecutors say Sharber forced the men out of their car and shot each of them three times. A sentencing memorandum in the case says they only survived because Sharber had used the wrong caliber ammunition and the cold weather slowed their bleeding. A passerby spotted them hours later and the men were flown by helicopter to a hospital. Taylor says the shootings came extremely close to being a double murder.
In every respect, with the exception of the ultimate result, it was a homicide. The intent was there, the plan was there, and the action was there. These men were bound. They were on the side of a mountain in below freezing weather in the snow in very early morning hours. And so, you know, this was as close as you can get to an actual murder.
Sharber's case on the drug charges continues in federal court. For fans of wild Alaska salmon, the start to this year's fishing season was tough. The famed Copper River Red Run was a bust, and the state has harshly restricted king salmon fishing in other areas. But now the sockeye runs in Bristol Bay and Cook Inlet are heating up. Nat Herz with Alaska's Energy Desk followed one shipment of salmon on its journey toward Anchorage dinner tables.
Alex Pfaff works 50 miles southwest of Anchorage, across the waters of Cook Inlet and off the road system. His job is catching salmon.
So I'm sitting on the beach, and I can see Mount Spur directly west of me, and I can see Mount Redoubt to the southwest.
Pfaff runs a family business called the Salmon Hookup. Like many others, Pfaff's season started late, thanks to state-ordered closures to preserve king salmon stocks. That's made the midsummer sockeye run hotly anticipated. When the salmon start swimming into his set nets, Pfaff says he can see them move.
We call it popcorn. Whenever fishing's good, that's when it's like popcorn popping. It's just hit. And that gets pretty exciting, all kinds of splashing. And sometimes a whole school of them will come through and you'll get a whole bunch of hits at once.
In Bristol Bay, Alaska's salmon hub, much of the fish gets delivered to processing plants. Pfaff's business is different. He sells straight to consumers in restaurants in Anchorage. The salmon arrives by bush plane at Merrill Field, the airport smack dab in the middle of Anchorage. I'm here with Pfaff's mom, Kathy, awaiting a load of sockeye and silvers.
Oh, perfect, thank you. So it'll be 10 minutes, and then our fish should be here.
When the plane lands, a couple of handlers pull out more than a dozen boxes, then cart them over to a scale.
745 pounds of fish.
Most of that fish is destined for individual customers. They arrive in trucks and SUVs with coolers in the back. One woman decided to buy her two silvers 12 hours earlier. Kathleen Katkiss says she found the Salmon Hookups ad on Craigslist.
Yeah, it was really late, actually, and I had really bad pregnancy cravings.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I think it was like 1 a.m.
Others use Pfaff's business to fill their freezers and as a way to escape the hordes that catch salmon on the Kenai Peninsula with dip nets. Paul Bauman is buying 15 fish. He arrives with a check for $510. He's a general contractor, and he says he carves out a full afternoon for salmon processing.
I just left the job site down on 15th and told him I've got stuff coming in I got to deal with, and I'll see you tomorrow. It's not like other states where you can go out fishing in a reservoir or lake and get a fish or two or three or four. Here, when the salmon are in, you got to deal with the salmon. Just like when the caribou are here, you got to deal with the caribou.
The rest of the fish goes to restaurants. From the airport, Kathy drives downtown in her Ford Explorer, then along a dingy back alley. Jose Martignan, one of the owners of Pangea Restaurant, comes out to meet us.
So this is Jose's box. This is your box. Yeah. Here's your fish.
What do you think?
Nice, beautiful. Look at the color in here. Look at the fat content in these pieces right here. That's all your flavor right there.
That's the belly, right?
That's the belly. Mm-hmm.
Spurnak Airways, which flies salmon for Pfaff and other fishermen, can carry 5,000 pounds to Anchorage in a single summer day. That's a tiny fraction of Alaska's overall catch. On Sunday, Bristol Bay fishermen brought in 1.3 million salmon. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Nat Herz in Anchorage.
The State Department of Transportation, contracting with Kinnick Construction, broke ground this past spring on the hub village of Aniak's new runway, a project long in the making. KYUK's Christine Trudeau has the details.
Currently, the project is in the excavation phase, while the airport's operations have continued undisturbed from construction. A rock pit has been dug, and soon DOT will bring in concrete mix materials to pave the new runway. The project's initial manager and designer, Morgan Merritt, said while some of the community would rather have stayed with the current situation, new construction was necessary for both cost and safety reasons. The old runway's paving conditions drive up maintenance costs, and federal authorities are requiring more space along the runways to be left clear for safety.
The safety of the separation distances and the possibility of accident.
So the Federal Aviation Administration wants what they call safety areas.
Well, if an aircraft was to, on approach, have a navigational or mechanical problem, it's been shown statistically that aircraft will land accidentally left or right of the runway. And that's why the FAA has established runway safety areas and object-free areas.
Merritt says the FAA is covering much of the cost for the new runway project, $53.6 million of which is covered by federal grants and $3.6 million by the state of Alaska. The inconveniences so far have been with traffic and dust, which Kinnick Construction and the DOT and the city of Aniak have been attending to. Kevin Toothaker, Aniak's city manager, says most of the traffic is due to travel to and from the new gravel pit. He adds that some buildings have already been demolished and trees have been cut in order to move Aniak's sewer main, part of the overall project redesign.
They cut off one of the roads, one of the ways to get to new housing and stuff through the west side of the airport. It's blocked off right now, but well, they redo the sewer. But I think that it's been kind of going smoothly. For the most part, and a lot of dust, but the Kinnick will run their water truck to help keep the dust down.
The community of Aniak overall has pulled together, regardless of any doubts they might have had about the project, says Toothaker. People helped during planned and unplanned power and sewer outages. This included the Kuspuk School District providing power to those needing it, and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation providing access to power and water off their well and generator as needed. Business organizations like YKHC have come together as an informal group, letting people know what services are available to them throughout the construction period. YKHC's operations manager in Aniak is Kimberly Madden.
Working together, with anything that comes our way, because we are out here on the island, we are our own help, so that's why we've pooled together to address a lot of things that have come up in Aniak. That's just our plan moving forward, and so far it's worked out really well.
Morgan Merritt says the new runway will actually be less wide than the existing one, but longer. It's already more than a mile long.
At present, it's 150 wide by 6,000 feet long. After the construction, the shifted runway will be 100 feet wide and 6,200 feet long. So it's narrower but longer as far as takeoff lengths.
But landing lengths will actually be shorter, which Merritt says a number of people in town, along with air carriers, are concerned about, especially for Boeing 737 freight. DOT analysis says the new runway will only make for tighter weight restrictions under certain flying conditions, and that the landing lengths should be adequate. The new runway is expected to open next year after the FAA installs navigation aids. In Bethel, I'm Christine Trudeau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Later this month, sections of the Dalton Highway north of Fairbanks are set for 5 separate day-long closures as crews install new culverts. The Dalton is the only overland supply route to the oil fields on Alaska's North Slope and is frequented in the summer by tourists heading to the Arctic. The Department of Transportation says the culverts are needed because of what's known as a frozen debris lobe that is headed toward the highway. Frozen debris lobes are slow-moving landslides that occur in permafrost and contain rock, soil, trees, and ice. According to University of Alaska Fairbanks researchers, a lobe was less than 80 feet from the roadway as of today and advancing at more than half an inch per day. Construction closures are scheduled between miles 209 and 222. DOT says the highway will be closed from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. on 3-day intervals starting on July 19th. Ancestral artifacts collected in the Kodiak Archipelago nearly 150 years ago have arrived back home. They are on loan from a museum in France and will remain at the Aleutic Museum and Archaeological Repository in Kodiak for 5 years. The objects were collected by a 19-year-old French anthropologist, Alphonse Pinard, a linguist who visited Kodiak in 1871 and 72. Dacia Eaton with KMXT attended a welcoming ceremony for the objects at the museum.
Alikia Kando works for the museum that's been caring for the items all these years. She's the director of the Musée Boulogne-sur-Mer in the north of France, and she escorted the crate to Kodiak. She told the crowd the exchange between the museums is a model for how cultural institutions can work together.
I think it's an example for not only for Kodiak, or not only for America, not only for France, but this example of the
She says the importance of inheriting this heritage is truly very strong here for future generations. Thank you for providing this example. Thank you for really giving it your all to these pieces that have been protected for years and that will be transmitted to future generations. Kando's museum is part of an international movement for partnerships between European collecting institutions and indigenous peoples so that both can learn more about cultural items. After a ceremony where a traditional Aleutic oil lamp was lit, they pried open the shipping crate. The pieces inside are part of the Pinard collection, which includes Kodiak Aleutic objects that Europeans collected here in the late 19th century. The collection includes many rare pieces of Aleutic ceremonial gear, like masks, drums, headdresses, and a feast bowl, which provide a rich record of traditional arts, ritual practices, spiritual beliefs, and the Aleutic language. Pinard also documented vocabulary, songs, and legends along with the objects. Inside the large crate are several smaller wooden boxes, which are removed one by one and staged on nearby tables. While the crowd waits for the screws to be taken out of the inner boxes, the Aleutic dancers sing a traditional call and response song. A line forms for onlookers to file by the tables where the objects sit. As the packing paper is removed, Aleutic descendants get their first glimpse of their ancestors' work. At last, the cultural treasures come into view, 2 carved wooden masks and a woman's beaded headdress set, which includes 2 bracelets and a dance belt. One elder greets the items in Aleutic. Aleutic elder Florence Matfay Pesterkoff, whose family was originally from Akiak, admires the headdress beads of white, green, and blue.
I am thankful that these people who took them from here preserved them for us.
She said she's never had a traditional headdress of her own and hopes to make one like it for herself. 22-year-old Derek Shaya, an intern at the Aleutic Museum, has been to France to see some of the objects, but he says he's still awed to have them here today.
I'm really particular to the masks, I think, just because there's so little that's written about them, and it was an art that was lost on Kodiak for a long time.
In September, the new items will be incorporated into displays on Aleutic Yakutic spirituality. In addition, the museum plans to assemble a group of beaters to study and recreate the regalia to share as replicas when the historic set returns to France. In Kodiak, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Today was the beginning of the end for Blockbuster in Alaska. The two remaining stores in Fairbanks and Anchorage began their inventory sales, selling off DVDs, Blu-rays, and video games. Even the racks they're displayed on are up for grabs. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell was at today's sale and talked to people about what Blockbuster has meant to them.
Ready?
Come on in, guys.
Come on in.
People flood into the two front doors at the Anchorage Blockbuster. They grab blue plastic shopping baskets and make a beeline to the aisles of DVDs. Within minutes, Hannah Lewis's basket is filled to the brim.
I have some new releases, a couple TV shows, and an Xbox game for Legos.
Hannah is 23 years old. She's lived in Alaska her entire life. She says she's been coming to Blockbuster for as long as she can remember.
When I was a kid, we came here, I would say, every day or every couple days because we were kids, we loved movies. And now since I'm adult, I come here, me and my boyfriend would come here every other week or so to rent some movies, because sometimes you can't find the stuff on TV.
There are more and more ways to rent or stream movies, like on Netflix, Amazon, or Hulu. But a lot of people here say streaming services don't have all the options, especially when it comes to the classics. That's what brings Diane to Blockbuster.
We're here quite often for the older movies and things like that.
Diane is a self-proclaimed Blockbuster regular. She comes in a couple times a week. Right now, she's standing in the checkout line with about 20 plastic DVD cases in her hands.
Walking Dead and Fear the Walking Dead.
A lot of them.
Yes. The ones I don't already own.
Diane says she'll miss the movies, sure, but really, she says it's the employees that have made Blockbuster so special. Diane says the general manager, Kevin Damude, knows her by name.
I've known a lot of these customers since 1993.
Kevin has been working here for decades. He says breaking the news to his staff and then customers, that's been the hardest part.
It kills me to sit there and tell them, and the reaction, you know, when you see people crying, you're like, God, don't do that. Please don't do that.
Kevin hugged customers, asking how their kids were, and dodging questions about what his plans were for life after Blockbuster.
It hurts your heart because, you know, this is the end of an era, you know. You think about it, this is Blockbuster's gone in Alaska, that's it.
Inventory sales will continue at the two remaining Blockbusters in Anchorage and Fairbanks through August. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Russell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Matt Miller in Juneau, Casey Grove, Nat Herz, and Emily Russell in Anchorage, Christine Trudeau in Bethel, and Daisha Eaton in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.